His name was Alan Kaufman. He was from Grass Valley in Northern California, and for some reason he wanted to get into the rock scene. He looked like a psychotic yuppie, with eyes always darting around the room as if he were expecting something to leap out of the shadows and attack him. When he got drunk, he'd start obsessively searching bushes we passed to make sure no one was hiding in them. It wasn't until years later, though, he discovered he had served as an MP in Vietnam. When Stick brought him by rehearsal, he'd probably never seen a rock band before, and we'd never seen a manager. He said he wanted to invest in us and gave us $50, the first money we ever made as a band. We signed a management deal with him on the spot. Establishing a pattern we would repeat throughout our career, within minutes we had spent the entire wad on a pile of cocaine and snorted it in one long line that snaked around the table. Kaufman backed us because he thought it would be cheap. A punk band may have been cheap, but we weren't. We had him buy a snakeskin jacket and black pants for Tommy, a new leather jacket for Mick, and for Nikki, a $600 pair of boots. Back then, if we wanted anything that had a price tag in the three digits, we had to steal it. Kaufman thought he'd train us in Grass Valley and let us work out the kinks in our live shows. We slept in his guest trailer and hitchhiked into the town, a redneck paradise with only one road, Main Street. Despite the shit-kicker nature of the place, we weren't deterred from wearing stiletto heels, hairspray, red-painted fingernails, hot pink pants, and makeup. In full costume, we descended on the bars trying to score speed from truckers and pick up on anyone's girlfriend. On our first night out, a Hell's Angel walked into the bar and stopped in front of a biker with an angel's tattoo on his arm. "You don't deserve to be a Hell's Angel anymore," he said calmly. Then he clicked out a stiletto blade and cut the guy's tattoo off on the spot. One of the gigs Kaufman scored for us was at a place called the Tommy Knocker, which had a big sign outside announcing Hollywood Costume Night. We walked in and saw a dozen cowboys with their girlfriends handcuffed to them. Everybody was confused. They thought they looked Hollywood and had no idea what planet we had come from. We thought we were Hollywood and had no idea what planet they had come from. We played Stick to Your Guns and Livewire, but they just stared at us, still bewildered. So we decided to speak their language and ripped into Jailhouse Rock and Hound Dog, which they went crazy for. We played Hound Dog 5 times that night, then escaped through the back door before we got killed. That night, someone told us about a party in town. We walked in, and it was full of hot chicks we had never seen before. After about 15 minutes, Tommy nudged me and said, "These aren't chicks, dude." We looked around and realized that we were surrounded by freaky country bumpkin drag queens who were probably wearing their wives' and girlfriends' clothes. I asked the big blonde next to me if he had any coke, and he sold me a bag for $20. I went into the bathroom to shoot up and almost killed myself. It was baby powder, and I was pissed. When the drag queen wouldn't give me my money back, I pulled his wig off, spun him around, and hit him in the face. Blood leaked over his lipstick, dribbling down his chin. All of a sudden, a dozen redneck transvestites descended on us, flailing and kicking with their high heels before throwing us into the street, a torn and bleeding lump of Hollywood trash. The next day, Kaufman arranged our first radio interview. We showed up at the studio with fat lips, bruises, and black eyes, and we were scared shitless. We had never done a radio interview before. They asked us where we were from, and we looked at each other speechless. Then Mick said, "Mars." After more nightmares that Kaufman called training, we migrated back south to Los Angeles, playing concerts and putting posters on every telephone pole we saw. They dropped me off at Lovey's, and within a minute I was in the bathtub shooting up with her while she blathered on about how Alan Kaufman was going to wear us out and how we should let her manage us with her dad's money. She was driving me out of my mind, especially since I'd started sleeping with a much nicer, cuter, and saner surfer girl who lived down the street. Lovey and I ended up partying until dawn at the house of a guy who was an heir to U.S. Steel, but was living in a squalid one-bedroom house because his family had cut him off. The next evening, I was still shooting up at Lovey's when I realized we had a gig at the country club in 10 minutes and I was stuck. I didn't have a car or any way to get down the hill she lived on. I sprinted out of the door and ran downhill until I managed to hitch a ride. I arrived at the club 45 minutes late, still wearing a bathrobe. The guys were freaked out. They were pissed that I was using needles and showing up for gigs dressed like an old man. They told me that if I shot up one more time, I was out of the band. They were so furious and self-righteous that it was hard to bite my tongue a few years later when Nicky and Tommy were using needles. From that night on, I was determined to escape from Lovie. I was stranded on Gilligan's Island, dependent on her money or her car if I wanted to go anywhere, and her drug supply if I didn't. A few mornings later, while Lovie was asleep, Tommy drove up to the house. I bundled my clothes in a sheet and threw them in the back of his truck. I didn't leave a note or even bother to call her afterward. She stopped by Tommy's every day after that, thinking she'd catch me there, but I managed to avoid her for 3 days. Then, when we were getting ready to take the stage for a gig at the Roxy, I spotted her pushing through the audience and told security to kick her out. Later that month, I moved into a two-bedroom apartment on Clark Street, just 50 steps from the Whiskey A Go-Go, which Kaufman had bought to keep Nicky, Tommy, and me together near the clubs. I didn't see Lovie again until 15 years later, back at the Roxy, when I was playing a solo gig. After the show, around midnight, she came backstage, dragging a little girl behind her that she said was her daughter. Just a few months later, I saw her on the news. She'd been stabbed 60 times in a drug deal gone wrong. I often wonder what became of her daughter, and hope that she wasn't mine.
Chapter 4. A band biography is distributed by post, with years of birth, spelling of names, and countries of origin intentionally fabricated in hopes of ameliorating a poor prospect for success, an overall lack of familiarity with the business of music, and a band with members too young to play in establishments that serve spirits. Kaufman & Kaufman Productions, 156 Mill Street, Grass Valley, California, 95945. For release, June 22, 1981. Motley Crue is the commercial hard rock band the 80s have been screaming for. In just a few months, Motley Crue has become the hottest group in Southern California. Motley Crue has set all-time attendance records at the Troubadour in Hollywood and has sold out the Country Club and the Whiskey A Go-Go. Motley Crue is one of the few acts to play the Roxy Theater without major record company support. Motley Crue will soon release their debut album on their own label, Leather Records. They provide an outstanding live show which excites, stimulates, and moves the audience. Motley Crue is as exciting to watch as they are to listen to. Motley Crue is four gifted artists doing what they do best, making timeless music. Nikki Sixx on bass guitar and vocals at 22 has made a lasting impression on the Hollywood scene with his former group, London. Nikki is an exceptional songwriter, heavily influenced by The Sweet and Cheap Trick, and is the inspiration behind much of Motley Crue's music. Mick Mars at 25 may be Newfoundland's greatest claim to fame. Mick's unique emotional guitar playing combines a fast sound with great showmanship. Mick assists on vocals, and his songwriting ability is a perfect blend with Nicky's. Together they create most of what is Motley Crue. Tommy Lee, age 21 on drums, is high energy personified. When Tommy picks up a stick, no one sits still. Whether he's playing sticks, drums, cymbals, gongs, cowbells, or wood blocks, Tommy's ability and showmanship are unequaled. He is another important component, uniquely contributing to Motley Crue. Vince Neil, fair-haired, 21, lead vocalist and writer, will have the girls' hearts throbbing. Vince commands the stage and his every move is watched intensely. Vince's unique styling and versatile range were influenced by John Lennon and Robin Zander. He is the final piece creating the band Motley Crue. When Nicky, Mick, Tommy, and Vince came together, the magic was instantaneous, and Motley Crue was born. The creative genius of these four performers has brought forth a new music that will not soon be forgotten. Their music and showmanship are a new driving force in rock. The themes which run through their songs involve the audience in a musical reality of day-to-day living, expressing joys and tragedies to which today's youth can relate. Motley Crue is what the youth of the 80s have been waiting for, the sound to move to, the words that speak, and the looks that heroes are made of. Motley Crue is not a rebellion, but a revolution in rock. a return to the hard-driving sound of the Beatles re-energized for the 80s. For booking information and interview requests, please call Kaufman & Kaufman Productions, 916-273-9554.
Chapter 5. Nicky. More on a gentleman who uses his fists for purposes of communication, persuasion, and artistic inspiration. I had been listening to him brag for an hour. He had dirty red hair, shaven in a half-hearted attempt at a mohawk, and a cuff in his ear. Not even a real piercing. Like every other punk rock poser, he had been hanging out at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go that night, watching the dying gasps of the L.A. punk scene. David Lee Roth and Robin Crosby and Stephen Piercy from Rat were partying with us at the Motley House that night. And the little punk kept trying to prove that he was more rock and roll than any of us, that he was tougher and more street than me, though he was clearly just a rich, self-deluded brat from Orange County. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. "You ain't a fucking punk, you motherfucker!" I leapt off the sofa, slammed his head against the table, yanked his ear, and pressed the lobe flat against the wood with my fingers. Then, with the whole room watching, I hammered a nail straight through his earlobe and into the table. "Ah!" he yelled, and writhed in pain, stuck to the table like a dog on a tight chain. "Now you're punk rock," I told him. We turned up the stereo and kept partying like he wasn't there. When I woke up the next afternoon, he was gone, but the nail was still mysteriously in the table. I tried to avoid imagining what he must have done to escape. I had reached a new place in life. No longer was I the downtrodden, victimized, sniveling, untalented wannabe begging the cool guys to let me join their band. I was in the cool band. I was recording my very own album with my very own songs. We had our own apartment in the middle of the scene that was the only place to be after hours. And we traveled around in Cadillacs that Kaufman rented for us. Ungrateful, we'd kick the doors in and destroy them without a thought for the cost. When we went out together, four male degenerates dressed like female sluts, people were drawn to our energy. If we walked into the Troubadour, everybody came with us. If we split, the club emptied. It felt like we were becoming the kings of L.A. It seemed like every guy wanted to be us and every chick wanted to fuck us, and all we had to do was simply be a band. It was the best time of my life, but it was also the darkest. I was a walking terror. The chip on my shoulder had grown to the size of a large boulder, and if anyone even tried to touch it, I'd smash it in their face. Man is like a Rottweiler or a tiger. He's a very beautiful animal, but if he gets pissed off and you're standing in range, you're going to go down no matter who you are. At least, that's the kind of man I was. One night, after waking up and drinking all day, Vince and I arrived early for a show at the Whiskey-A-Go-Go. When I walked in, a jock with feathered hair sneered, "Who do you think you are, Keith Richards or Johnny Thunders?" I didn't say a word. I grabbed his face and started smashing it into the side of the bar, shattering glasses and covering the counter with blood. The bouncer walked up to me and instead of kicking me out, smiled. "Cool, dude," he said. "We'll get you some free drinks for that. Do you mind if I call you Muhammad Ali, Six?" He walked Vince and me upstairs and we continued swigging Jack Daniels. But while I was getting a hand job from a girl at the bar, Vince slipped away. I combed the entire club and asked everyone if they had seen him. It wasn't until later that night when I was leaving the club that I found him passed out underneath a blue Ford Malibu with his feet sticking out the side like a car mechanic. I dragged Vince home where we found a girl handcuffed to his bed. Though Tommy was nowhere to be seen, she was one of his victims, the daughter of a famous athlete. I saw her recently, working on the pirate ship at Disneyland. It was good to see that she was still around handcuffs. Vince passed out with the girl still handcuffed to his bed. When he awoke at midnight, the girl was gone, Tommy was back, and we all went out again. There was a homeless girl who was a fixture on the strip. She was young, crazy, and always wore a Cinderella costume. One night, we picked her up and brought her home so that Tommy could try to sleep with her. And while he was in bed with her, we stole her costume. After she left the house in tears, with Tommy's clothes hanging off her, No one ever saw her in the streets again. Once we had taken clothes from a homeless girl, there were no taboos. I even tried to fuck Tommy's mother, but failed miserably. When his dad found out, he told me, "If you can get in there, you can have it." After that, I started dating a German model, or at least a skinny German who told me she was a model. She had photos of herself hanging around the guys in Queens, so I was impressed. Her upstairs neighbor, Fred, wanted to teach me how to freebase, and that annoyed the German girl, who we nicknamed Himmler. Every week, Himmler came by the house, and we celebrated with Nazi Wednesdays. We walked around in armbands, goose-stepping, and Sieg Heiling. Instead of torching the cockroaches on the wall with flaming jets of hairspray, we scooped them up and burned them with their compatriots in the oven. When they died, they'd stand up on their back legs and then keel over while we barked at them in fake German. "Hey," she scolded in her deep guttural accent, "that is not funny. Many millions of people have died in the ovens." After we broke up, I dated a groupie with a narrow waist, a Sheena Easton haircut, and fuck-me eyes. Her name was Stephanie. Her parents owned a luxury hotel chain, and she was smart enough to know that the quickest way to our hearts was to bring us drugs and groceries. I met her at the Starwood when she was hanging around the guys from Rat. I loved dating her. We'd go to her apartment and do blow and quaaludes, and then I'd get to fuck her, which was great because I didn't have any money to buy blow and quaaludes, and I couldn't fuck myself, though I'm about to fuck myself over with this story. She would let me do anything. On one of our first dates, she took me out to dinner, and I used a bottle of wine on her underneath the table. One night, Vince, Stephanie, and I were hanging out at the Rainbow, eating quaaludes and escargot, and throwing up under the table every 15 minutes. We got plastered, took her back to the house, and all ended up in Vince's bed. That was never my scene. Tommy and Vince were always piling chicks together, but having a guy there wrecked the moment for me. I couldn't get it up and eventually went back to my room, leaving the two of them alone. That was the last time I saw Stephanie naked, because once you put Vince in the same room as a girl with money and a nice car, it's all over. They dated for months after that, and were about to get married when Vince found a richer girl, Beth, with blonde hair and a better car, a 240Z. I don't know how we ever dragged our incestuous, partied-out little selves to the next level as a band, because we didn't even believe that a next level existed. It was just about packing people into our shows and making sure they left talking about us. We even called Elvira one night, who agreed to introduce us if Kaufman paid her $500 and picked her up in a black town car. The longer we lived together, the better our concerts became because we had more time to dream up stupid antics. Vince started chainsawing the heads off mannequins. Blackie Lawless had stopped lighting himself on fire because he was tired of burning his skin, so I took over because I didn't give a shit about the pain. I would have swallowed tacks or fucked a broken bottle if it would have brought more people to our shows. With each new gig, our stage setup looked better and better. Mick had a dozen lights he had bought from Don Dokken and a PA he had stolen from his old Top 40 band, White Horse. We had a dirty white blood-stained bedsheet that we stripped from Tommy's bed and painted our name on in big black letters. Inspired by Queen, Tommy and Vince built a three-tiered drum riser, a frame of 2x4s painted white with stretched black cloth over the top and mounted with 15 flashing lights and skulls and drumsticks. It weighed a ton and was a pain in the ass to assemble each show. We also made small plexiglass boxes filled with lights that we would climb on, pose from, and leap off. The whole show was a hodgepodge of whatever looked cool and cheap to us. We painted the drum heads, stuck candelabras all over the stage, mounted voodoo heads on the ends of drumsticks, tied handkerchiefs on whatever we could, decorated our guitars with colored tape, wrapped telephone cords around ourselves, and use the most evil recordings we could find to pump up the crowd before our concerts. When we sold out a series of shows at the Whiskey, I was so ecstatic I called my grandparents and said, "You're not going to believe it. We sold out three nights at the Whiskey. We fucking made it." "Made what?" he asked. "Nobody even knows who you are." And he was right. We were selling out show after show, but no label would sign us. They told us our live show was too erratic, and there was no way our music would ever get on the radio or make the pop charts. Heavy metal was dead, they kept telling us. New wave was all that mattered. Unless we sounded like the Go-Go's or the Knack, they weren't interested. We didn't know about charts or radio program directors or new wave. All we knew about was raw fucking Marshall stacks of rock and roll blasting in our crotches and how much fucking blow, Percodan, Quaaludes, and alcohol we could get for free. The only reason I wanted a record deal was so that I could impress girls by telling them I had one. So we solved that problem by creating our own label, Leather Records. We booked time in the cheapest studio we could find, a $60 an hour outhouse on a bad stretch of Olympic Avenue. Mick liked the place because it had a trident board and really small rooms that he said were great for natural reverb. Mick fired the house engineer and brought in Michael Wagner, a jovial cherubic German who used to be in the metal band Accept. Together, we spit out Too Fast for Love in 3 drunken days. When we couldn't get anyone to even agree to distribute the album, Kaufman did it himself, driving around in his rented Lincoln, trying to talk record stores into carrying a couple copies. Within 4 months, however, we had a distributor, Green World, and had sold 20,000 albums, which wasn't bad for a record that cost $6,000 to make. We celebrated the album's release with a party at the Troubadour, which was one of my favorite clubs because there was a guy there I really enjoyed beating up. He had long hair and idolized us, but he was a pest and suffered deservedly for it. I had just finished pushing him backward over Tommy, who was positioned behind him on all fours, when I saw a girl with thick platinum blonde hair, apple red cheeks, heavy blue eyeshadow, tight black leather pants, a punk rock belt, and thigh-high black boots. She walked up and said, "Hi, I'm Lita, Lita Ford, with the Runaways. What's your name?" "Rick," I said. "Really?" she asked. "Yeah, I'm Rick." I was pretty full of myself and assumed that everyone knew my name. "Sorry," she said. "I thought you were someone else." "Well, you thought wrong," I sneered, with my nose stuck in its usual place up in the air. "That's too bad, Rick," she said, "because I wanted to split a Quaalude with you." "You did?" I began to pay attention. "I thought you were Nikki." "I am Nikki. I am Nikki." I practically wet myself like a dog in pursuit of a treat. She bit the Quaalude in half and stuck it in my mouth, and that was it. We began talking and hanging out. Prior to meeting her, I had thought of most women the way I thought of my first girlfriend, Sarah Hopper, as pests who were sometimes useful as alternatives to masturbation. But Lita was a musician, and I could relate to her. She was nice, normal, and smart. In the furious tempest that my life had become, here was someone I could cling to, someone to help keep my feet on the ground. One night, Lita, Vince, Beth, and I were leaving the Rainbow when a biker started pushing the girls around and asking if they wanted to fuck him. The bikers had declared war on the rockers back then. We watched for a minute and then walked up to him. We were in a good mood, so we didn't hit him. We asked him to stop. He glared at us and told us to fuck off. I was wearing a chain around my waist attached to a piece of leather and a buckle. I whipped the chain off my waist and started swinging it in the air, trying to crack heads. Suddenly, a couple more people joined the fight. One of them, a hairy 6'4" beast, charged at me like a bull, knocking the wind out of me and pushing me back into the bushes. I reached for the chain on the ground, and he grabbed my hand with his leather glove, stuck it in his mouth, and bit it through to the bone. I screamed, and in a rush of adrenaline, grabbed the chain and started whipping him across the face with it. All of a sudden, he pushed me back, pulled out a gun, and said, "You're under arrest, motherfucker!" In the commotion, I didn't even realize that the two people who had joined the fight weren't the bikers' friends, but undercover cops. They cracked me 7 times across the face with their billy clubs, breaking one of my cheekbones and blackening an eye. Then they handcuffed me and tossed me into their squad car. From the back seat, I saw Vince running away like a glam chicken, probably because he'd just been arrested at the Troubadour a few weeks before for hitting a girl who didn't like the U.S. Marines outfit he was wearing. "Fucking punk," the big cop yelled at me. "Hitting a cop. What the fuck do you think you're doing?" The car screeched to a halt at the head of an alley. He grabbed both my elbows with one hand, dragged me out of the car, and threw me on the ground. Then he and his partner started kicking me in the stomach and face. Whenever I turned onto my stomach to try to shield myself from the blows, they'd rolled me onto my side so they could kick me where it hurt more. I went to jail that night covered in smeared makeup, fingernail polish, and blood. They charged me with assault with a deadly weapon on a police officer. I spent 2 nights there with the cops threatening to put me away for 5 years without parole. The police, however, didn't end up pressing charges because a scandal soon developed when dozens of people accused the cops of harassing them and beating them up on the Sunset Strip. Lita hawked her prized Firebird Trans Am for $1,000 to make my bail. We walked 3 miles from jail back to the Motley House to meet the band in time for a show at the Whiskey that night. Afterward, accompanied by the sounds of Tommy's girlfriend, Bullwinkle, smashing everything of value we had in the house, I pulled out a lined yellow notepad and vented my anger. A star-spangled fight. Heard a steel-belted scream. Sinners in delight. Another sidewalk's bloody dream. I heard the sirens whine. My blood turned to freeze. See the red in my eyes. Finished with you, you'll make my disease. No, that last line wasn't right. As I crossed it out, the door flew off its hinges, and Tommy crashed to the ground, his head cut open, and Bullwinkle towering over him like an angry moose. Your blood's coming my way, I scribbled beneath the crossed-out line. Better, but not perfect. The next morning, a lawyer came by with an eviction notice. We had been in the house for 9 months, constantly drinking, fighting, fucking, practicing, and partying, and we were all sick and haggard. We needed a little mothering. So I moved in with Lita on Coldwater Canyon in North Hollywood. Vince moved into Beth's apartment, and Tommy moved in with Bullwinkle. I don't know where Mick was. Maybe we left him hanging upside down in one of our closets. We never bothered to check.
Part 4. Shout at the Devil. Chapter 1. Tom Zutaut. A wage earner in the employ of Elektra Records embarks on an adventure in which the discovery is made that a group of most ill repute has a manager of yet more dubious standing. I think that the only reason I ever succeeded was because of my passion. I always went beyond what anyone else was doing to get something I wanted. Like, when I was a DJ at my high school station in Park Forest, Illinois, I heard about a radio conference at Loyola University and signed myself up. It was there that I discovered I could get free records. Our high school radio station had been operating for years, and not once had it occurred to them that they didn't have to buy their own albums. My first job out of school was in the mailroom of the Chicago WEA distribution branch, a position I only got because I impressed someone at the label while I was on the phone begging for free Cars records. Eventually, that same passion earned me a promotion to Los Angeles, where I worked as an assistant in the sales department at Elektra Records, which at that time had acts like Jackson Browne, Queen, the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt, and 29 with Lenny White. I suppose if I wasn't enterprising, I never would have pulled over that Thursday night on Sunset Boulevard. It was early evening, and I was cruising Sunset hoping to get a bite to eat at a coffee shop called Ben Frank's, which was always packed with young rockers being served by 70-year-old waitresses who had been working there since the Lana Turner days of Hollywood, when I noticed hundreds of kids trying to get into a concert at the Whiskey. I looked up at the marquee to see who was playing, and it read, Motley Crue, sold out. That same passion and obsession that led me to go to the radio convention at Loyola tugged on me, urging me to pull over when my stomach was growling with hunger. In the front window of a record store on the corner, Licorice Pizza, I saw a huge display featuring 4 glam-looking, leather-clad, androgynous refugees from the New York Dolls. I also noticed that they'd put out an album on their own label, Leather. For a band that didn't even have a record deal to be creating that kind of hysteria at the Whiskey was pretty rare. I had to see them. I walked up to the front door, pulled out my Elektra business card, and bluffed my way in, telling them I was an A&R man for the label. I was always trying to get the label to sign the bands I was into, but they never listened to me. I gave them I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett, which I found on the B-side of a European single, Tainted Love by Soft Cell, The Human League, and even The Go-Go's, and they passed on all of them. I was too shy to rub it in their faces, though. I felt lucky to even be working for a record label in Los Angeles at age 20. Inside the club, 500 teenagers, the club's capacity, were going berserk for this Motley Crue band, and they looked amazing. Nicky was so intense, it seemed like he would be in the streets killing somebody if he wasn't playing bass. He hit the strings so hard that he kept splitting the skin between his fingers. Watching him throttle that thing, with blood flying off his fingers, the strings seemed like razor blades. Vince was one of the best-looking and most charismatic singers I'd ever seen. Women's legs spread open just watching him sing. He was the exact opposite of the guitarist. Looking at him was like seeing Satan reincarnated, though he turned out to be the nicest of the bunch when he wasn't drinking. Tommy looked like an overexcited kid, but at the same time, he seemed like the only natural-born musician in the band. He was a high-quality drummer, a good showman, and constantly in motion. He seemed like the linchpin that held the whole thing together. After the show, I found their manager and told him that I wanted to bring the band into a meeting at Elektra. To my surprise, he completely brushed me aside. He told me instead to talk to Greenworld, a small local distributor that was handling their album. By coincidence, there was a music trade show in town, and Greenworld had a booth there. I talked to a man named Alan Niven, who put me back in touch with the band's strange manager, an overly serious building contractor named Alan Kaufman. Before I got too serious with Motley Crue, I wanted to make sure I wasn't overstepping my bounds at Elektra. I asked the A&R department if I could sign the band, and they laughed in my face. But I was persistent. I put together a file with letters from the A&R department rejecting all the bands I'd brought to them that went on to have hits at other labels. At the urging of my boss in the sales department, I presented the letters to Joe Smith, the chairman of Elektra, who, to my surprise, rose to the challenge. "Okay, wise guy," he told me. "You think you can do this? Fine. Then let's sign this band and see how good you really are." I was the laughingstock of Hollywood for courting these guys. The music that was popular at the time was British New Wave, Haircut 100, A Flock of Seagulls, Dexy's Midnight Runners. Hipper kids were into Elvis Costello, The Clash, and other bands riding the tail end of the punk movement. Everyone kept laughing at me for trying to sign a metal band. They'd come up to me at work and say, "What are you thinking? This is not going to get played on the radio. You can't reinvent Kiss." But I believed in Motley Crue because that crowd at the Whiskey believed in Motley Crue. You don't need ears to be a talent scout. You need eyes. So, on my tiny sales department assistant expense account, I began wining and dining the crew, who I think only came along for the free food. During each meal, Tommy fidgeted madly. Just like on stage, he couldn't keep still. Mick became more demonic with each drink until he started hallucinating and seeing purple people eaters, and Vince usually fucked the waitress in the bathroom. Nicky was the only one who took the meeting seriously. He had mapped out each step for the band's future in his head. He knew that the kids were sick of New Wave, that they were angry at punk for having sold out, and that they were bored to death with Fleetwood Mac and Foreigner and light FM pop. He wanted to expand those 500 kids at the Whiskey into a national rock and roll revolution that Motley Crue was going to lead. And he did. But not without a lot of struggling. When we were finally ready to sign a deal, Virgin Records showed up out of the blue. They met with the band and brought a briefcase filled with $10,000 in cash to dangle in front of their starving faces. Virgin at that time didn't have a label or distribution deal in America. They operated out of England, and they tried to use that to seduce Motley Crue, telling them that they could be like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Led Zeppelin, and break into America by getting popular in England first. I think that was a romantic notion to the band. That, and the aphrodisiac of a $10,000 cash advance and a $100,000 deal. In the end, although Virgin offered about $25,000 more than us, the band decided that it would be smarter for a Los Angeles rock band to sign with a Los Angeles rock label. None of us knew that Elektra would soon be relocating its offices to Manhattan. After we hammered out our final points and agreed to sign the deal, Kaufman, the band, some Elektra staffers, and I celebrated at Casa Cugat's, a Mexican restaurant owned by the rumba king Xavier Cugat. Motley Crue didn't need much to start a party back then, so things got wild pretty quickly. The odd thing, though, is that I expected crazy antics from the band, not from their uptight manager. However, he got so drunk that he ended up speaking Vietnamese as if he were a soldier back in Nam. He became convinced that there were gooks hiding behind tables and storehouses of ammunition in the kitchen. He downed another shot, then ran into the bathroom. When he didn't reappear after several minutes, Mick asked me to check on him. I'd always thought of Kaufman as a by-the-book kind of guy who served as babysitter for this wild band, so it came as a shock when I found him in the process of ripping a payphone out of the bathroom wall. I pulled him away and asked someone in Elektra's press department to keep an eye on the band and pick up the tab while I drove Kaufman home in my beat-up company car. As we were cruising north on La Cienega, he kept trying to rip the handle off the car door. Just as we reached the center divide at Santa Monica Boulevard, he pushed the door open and rolled out of the car into the middle of the intersection. I looked back and saw him between traffic lanes, crawling on his belly like a soldier with a rifle. Cars were whizzing past him, beeping and yelling, and it seemed like only a matter of seconds before someone would squash him flat. I pulled over, ran back, and grabbed him. He started swinging at me and cursing as if I were a North Vietnamese soldier trying to capture him as a prisoner of war. I really thought that he might kill me. But through some sort of adrenaline kick, I managed to bring him back into the car and to his hotel room. By the time I got back to the restaurant, the party had moved elsewhere. A week later, the names on the contract were finally inked, and the band insisted on making the record label pay for another party. So, we piled into our company cars and took the band to Benihana on La Cienega. It began as a very civil dinner, with the chef showing off his knife tricks. The band ate some and drank a lot. Vince, of course, was drinking the heaviest. I noticed that his margarita glass was broken, so he ordered another one. When I looked at him again, the new glass was broken, and he was insisting on a replacement. The perplexed waitress brought him yet another drink, examining the glass carefully to make sure there were no chips or cracks. As soon as she walked away, Vince put the glass to his mouth and bit into it, shattering the edge of the glass. "This guy is nuts," I thought. "He could cut his tongue out or tear his lips to shreds." Vince stood up, signaled the waitress, and accused her of giving him broken glass on purpose. She swore up and down that the glass was fine when she gave it to him. Then she turned to me for explanation. I didn't want to get her or Vince in trouble. "Maybe the dishwasher is broken," I offered weakly. So she brought him another margarita and retreated to the corner with the manager to spy on Vince. Unaware that she was watching, Vince sunk his teeth into the glass again. Instantly, the manager ran over and tried to kick us out of the restaurant while the waitress called the police. I quickly settled the bill and broke the party up. Most nights were like that with the band. Either something was going to get broken or someone was going to pass out. Nothing was ever easy with them. The head of A&R at Elektra, Kenny Batiste, was furious that I had gone over his head and gotten permission from Joe Smith to sign the band. So he did everything he could to make my life difficult. We were originally just going to re-release the Too Fast for Love album they had put out on their own, but Batiste convinced the label that the quality wasn't up to radio standards and the only way to put it out would be to remix it. I was against it, and the band was nervous. But if a remix was what it took to make the band a priority at Elektra, we were willing to play along. When they chose Roy Thomas Baker to rework the record, I practically wet my pants. Here I was, at age 20, meeting the eccentric British maverick who produced Queen, Foreigner, The Cars, Journey, and all these other amazing records. And though his last-minute mixing, phasing, and production tricks took away some of the raw charm of the original Motley album, I learned a lot by watching him work and hearing his stories. After the band spent the day in the studio, he'd usually invite them up to his house, where they'd be snorting cocaine off his plexiglass piano while he told them about the time Freddie Mercury wrote Bohemian Rhapsody at that very piano while getting a blowjob. RTB, as we called him, was a man who took great pleasure in throwing the perfect party. From Thursday night until Monday, there was a never-ending parade of interesting people, beautiful women, alcohol, and other party favors at his house. It was the ultimate producer's pad up in the hills on Sunset Drive, from the remote control settings on his bed to the thick shag carpeting. The sky was the limit there. 20 naked people packed into the jacuzzi, food eaten off women's bodies, and anything else you, I, or Caligula could imagine. Motley Crue and RTB were a perfect match. I always felt out of place, like a kid from Chicago who had somehow been transported into this glamorous movie where I got to meet all my favorite rock stars, Elton John, Rod Stewart, and guys from Queen, Journey, and Cheap Trick. Some parties were so besotted that RTB would push these buttons and lock everybody in. That way, if anybody wanted to leave, they'd have to get clearance with a security guard and make sure they weren't too drunk to drive. RTB was a smart guy. He knew that if he was going to facilitate this kind of mayhem, he needed to minimize the potential for accidents that he'd be held responsible for. And looking at the state some guests were in, he probably saved a lot of lives. As we were finishing the remix of Too Fast for Love, Kaufman suddenly decided to send the band on a tour of Canada, even though there was no record to promote yet. We protested and told him it was pointless, but Kaufman was adamant. We never understood why Kaufman made the band tour Canada until the truth came out in a lawsuit later. He had sold a portion of his stake in the band to a Michigan kid named Bill Larson, who had pooled his parents' life savings, about $25,000, so that he could own 5% of Motley Crue, Inc. In order for Kaufman to collect the money, he had to send the band up north to tour. So the band arrived in Canada to embark on a miserable, disastrous road trip with a co-manager they had never met or heard of before. There were bomb threats, border problems, fistfights, acid-addled hockey players, broken bones, mostly Kaufman's, and cops standing on the side of the stage at some shows to make sure the audience didn't kill the band. Soon afterward, Kaufman vanished, along with Elektra's entire advance and the poor Michigan kid's money. Perhaps he left because the band had started asking too many questions about where all their money was going. Money he probably felt like he deserved after mortgaging his house 3 times to pay for all the rental cars and hotel rooms, and God knows what else the band had damaged. Ultimately, the person who was hurt most was Bill Larson, whose father died of a heart attack because of the stress. Larson sued, though no one was ever able to find Kaufman to serve the subpoena. From what I heard, Kaufman's wife divorced him, his kid stopped speaking to him, and he became a born-again Christian. When Elektra released Too Fast for Love, it was a disaster. The priority for the label was an Australian band called Cold Chisel, and everybody in the promotions department was intent on making them the next big thing. I happened to be listening in on a conference call when I heard a regional promotions man say to the head of the radio department, "Listen, I've got a station in Denver and another in Colorado Springs that just added Motley Crue. They're not interested in Cold Chisel, but I'll keep working on them." "I don't give a fuck about Motley Crue," the radio department head yelled back. "They're not a priority. I don't want those ads. You tell those stations that if they add Motley Crue, they can go fuck themselves." When I heard that, I hit the ceiling. It was bad enough that the label wasn't helping Motley Crue, but now they were actually trying to hurt them. So I blew the whistle to Joe Smith. Because of that incident and several similar ones, the head of promotions was replaced. Around the same time, Tom Werman came to the label as the new head of A&R. Werman had produced the first Ted Nugent album and some of Cheap Trick's best music, and he was so excited about Motley Crue that he insisted on producing their next record. He and Nicky were very much in tune. Nicky wanted a bad boy image, but at the same time had a pop sense and wanted his music to cross over into the mainstream, which is what Werman tried to do with the bands he produced. Despite the best efforts of the promotions department to sabotage the record for some mysterious reason, Too Fast for Love ended up selling more than 100,000 copies, all through word of mouth. I didn't know what to do because the band had a major label record deal, had sold a respectable amount of albums, could sell out any club in L.A., were getting a buzz in the industry, and were beginning to write their second album, but they had no manager and were all broke and starving. I tried to take care of them the best I could. When I was 16, Lita Ford was the girl that I dreamed about. A total rock fox. I had posters of the Runaways all over the bedroom in my parents' house. Now, just 5 years later, I'd signed Motley Crue, and Nikki Sixx was living with one of the Runaways. And not only was I hanging out with them, but I was also giving them food and money. I'd stop by Nikki and Lita's house when I could and bring them Haagen-Dazs ice cream or a Subway sandwich. People always said that the pair of them fought like cats and dogs, but they were always fun to be with. As time passed, however, the house kept getting creepier. I'd drop in and see the Necronomicon, a black magic spell book, lying on the table. Nikki was getting heavily into satanic stuff and wanted to call the record Shout with the Devil. It was upsetting to the label, and it was upsetting to me. I knew the promotions department would use the title as an excuse to completely ignore the album. I went over one night to have a discussion with Nikki about changing the title. When I walked in, He and Lita were huddled on the couch. I'm kind of freaked out, Lita said. Weird things are happening in the apartment. What do you mean? I asked, looking around at the freshly painted pentagrams and Gothic paintings that Nikki had on the walls and floor. Weird things just happen, she said. Cabinet doors keep opening and shutting. There are weird noises, and things keep flying around the apartment for no reason. Listen, Nikki, I said. You have to stop fooling around with this satanic black magic shit. It's powerful stuff, and if you don't know what you're doing, don't mess with it. But Nikki didn't care for grandstanding. It's nothing, he said. It just looks cool. It's meaningless symbols and shit. I'm just doing it to piss people off. It's not like I fucking worship Satan or something. I knew I couldn't change his mind, so I left. When I returned 2 nights later, there were forks and knives sticking in the walls and ceiling, and Nikki and Lita looked much paler and sicker than usual. What the hell have you guys been doing? I asked. We aren't doing anything, man, Lita said. I tried to tell you. Stuff is just flying around here on its own. As she said that, and I swear to God I saw this with my own eyes, a knife and a fork rose off the table and stuck into the ceiling just above where I was sitting. I looked at Nikki and freaked out. There is no more shout with the devil. If you keep shouting with the devil, you're going to get killed. You can believe what you want, but I truly believe that Nikki had unknowingly tapped into something evil, something more dangerous than he could control that was on the verge of seriously hurting him. Nikki must have realized the same thing because he decided on his own to change the album title to Shout at the Devil. To this day, that incident remains one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen in my life. Fortunately, I soon met a booking agent named Doug Thaler, and he knew a guy, Doc McGee, who had a lot of money and wanted to start a management company. Doc was a charming little guy who knew how to say all the right things. We're going to make Motley Crue the biggest rock and roll band in the world, he said, and whatever money Elektra won't put up to make this happen, I will. Everything seemed perfect. Motley Crue had money, they had a guy named Barry Levine helping them with their image, and they became a record company priority. Thanks to Doc's masterful manipulation, generous imagination, and under-the-table gifts, Nikki was finally on the verge of moving his rebellion from the whiskey to the stadiums. But, of course, nothing happens for those guys without a struggle. I woke up a few weeks later to find out that Joe Smith had been fired, and a guy named Bob Krasnow was running the company. He fired Tom Werman and replaced him with Roy Thomas Baker, which was fine because now there were even more reasons to go to RTB's parties, and Werman still wanted to produce the record. But just as we were getting ready to record, Krasnow flew to Los Angeles and called Werman and me into a meeting. Rock and roll isn't happening, he told us. I've decided that I don't want any rock bands on the label. I wouldn't take Ozzy Osbourne if you gave him to me for free in a silver platter. Why would you drop a group who are selling lots of records? That doesn't make any sense, Bob. This is Elektra Records, Tom, he said. We have a tradition of fine, talented acts like Linda Ronstadt, The Doors, and Jackson Browne. I'm not in the circus business, and I'm not giving them a penny. Their managers are willing to take care of some of the promotion and touring costs. Listen, he said. The group is just awful. I saw their video, and it's embarrassing. I had it taken off MTV. What? We just lined up a tour for the band with Kiss. You can't do that. I heard about that, and I've canceled the dates. I called Doug Thaler and Doc McGee in to meet with Krasnow, and he told them the same thing. They responded by asking him what they needed to do to release Motley Crue from their contract with Elektra. I'll tell you what, Krasnow relented. You make the best record that you can make. Don't worry about money, but keep the budget reasonable. I won't promise you that I'll put it out, but I will promise you that I'll make it easier for you to take it someplace else. If they had been dropped then and lost the momentum they had built up, it probably would have been the end of Motley Crue. But fortunately, something happened to change Bob's mind. And that something was the US Festival. Less than a year later, Krasnow would be dressed in a Motley Crue bandana at Madison Square Garden, presenting the band with awards for gold and platinum album sales. Chapter 2 Vince. A day of public triumph ends in private recrimination as our hero submits to his baser instincts, which shall not be disclosed in more titillating detail in this brief synopsis for fear of corrupting younger readers. It was the day that New Wave died and rock and roll took over. May 29th, 1983. Day two of the three-day US Festival. Circling above hundreds of thousands of kids in a helicopter, the first helicopter we'd ever been in, it seemed as if the scene on Sunset Strip on Friday and Saturday nights had suddenly been transported to a field in the middle of nowhere on a sweltering hot spring afternoon. Ozzy Osbourne, Judas Priest, the Scorpions, and Van Halen were performing in front of 300,000 kids. And so were we. Every city in America must have sprouted its own equivalent of the Sunset Strip. This wasn't an underground thing anymore. It was a mass movement. And finally we were all meeting to put a new nation on the map. Looking down on and off from the helicopter, with a bottle of Jack in my left hand, a bag of pills in my right hand, and a blonde head bobbing up and down in my lap, I felt like the king of the world. That lasted for about a second, then I got scared shitless. We only had one album out, and it had just grazed the pop charts at number 157. Most of these kids probably didn't even know us. They'd been in the heat all day and would probably hate us because they were impatient for Ozzy and Van Halen. I took another swig of Jack as we landed and met our new managers, Doc McGee, who was basically a drug dealer with good business sense, and Doug Thaler, his yes man. The guy who had signed us to Elektra, Tom Zutaut, was there with his girlfriend, a surprisingly hot chick considering Tom's luck with women. I went to the dressing room to put on my makeup and costume and see what I could do for the line of girls and reporters waiting outside. After what seemed like just a few minutes, there was a frantic knocking on the door. "You're supposed to be on stage 10 minutes ago," Doc yelled. "Get the fuck out there!" From the moment we played Shout at the Devil, I knew that we had made it. I had nothing to worry about. These people had never heard the song before. We had hardly even begun recording the album. But by the end, they were singing along, pumping their fists into the air. I looked out, and with every word I sang, with every guitar lick Mick played, the crowd rippled in response. I understood then why rock stars have such big egos. From the stage, the world is just one faceless, shirtless, obedient mass as far as the eye can see. Mick left the stage first and walked back to the trailer that doubled as our dressing room. Waiting for him inside was his girlfriend, who we called The Thing, a big mean brunette whose sleeves were rolled up above her elbows. As soon as we walked in the door, after having played the biggest concert of his life, she hauled off and punched him square in the face without a word of explanation. Back in Manhattan Beach, she would sometimes get drunk, beat him up, and kick him out of the house, after which Nikki or I would get a desperate phone call from Mick asking us to pick him up at his doorstep. Afterward, for me, was a blur of alcohol, drugs, interviews, and chicks. I remember walking off stage and seeing Tom Zutaut's girlfriend, who had stripped down to a leopard skin bikini because it was so hot outside. I grabbed her, pressed my sweaty face against hers, and stuck my tongue down her throat. She pressed her body against me and bit my lip. I brought her back to the trailer, past Mick, who was sitting on the steps holding his head in his hands, and buried my face in the girl's tits. Just then there was a knock on the door, and a squeaky voice said, "Hey, it's Tom. Can I come in?" "What do you want?" I asked, worried that he had seen me. "I just wanted to tell you that you were, amazing. That was the best show I've ever seen you play." "Thanks, dude," I said. "Listen, I'll be out in a minute. I just need a little while to chill out." Then I tore off his girlfriend's bikini and fucked the shit out of her while he waited outside. Nikki turned red when I told him what I had done. "You fucking asshole," he screamed. "Can't you keep your dick to yourself? That dude signed us. If he finds out, he's gonna hold it against us and seriously fuck up our new album." "Sorry," I replied. "But that's only if he finds out." Chapter 3. Tom Zutaut. A delicate matter is broached over the course of a brief interview with Tom Zutaut, an innocent and well-intentioned benefactor. "Tell me about the US Festival." "I just remember driving into the middle of nowhere, and the band getting paid a lot of money by some guy from Apple to play this concert in front of all these people."
"Do you remember anything else notable about that day?"
"Well, it was kind of weird seeing them play outside in the middle of the day."
"Did you go to the festival with anybody?"
"I went with Doc McGee and Doug Thaler."
"Anybody else?"
Yeah, my girlfriend went with me.
Did anything strange happen with your girlfriend that day?
No, not that I can remember.
Because Vin said he slept with her.
He slept with my girlfriend?
That's what he told me.
No, it couldn't have been her.
He said she was wearing a leopard skin bikini.
Okay, then it was a different girl. The real meaningful girlfriend wouldn't have worn a leopard skin bikini. It was probably some trashy date I was with. Nikki has probably been worried about it all these years, but she didn't mean anything to me.
It was Vince, not Nikki.
It was Vince? Well, Vince had a never-ending stream of girls. He would do 10 girls before the set and 10 after. You used to look at him and say, man, where does he get it? He never stops. I used to be amazed because he had a steady girlfriend. When she was around, they were like married, but the minute she turned her head, he'd be fucking someone else. I'm not surprised. I think if I try and go back and remember, there was a girl I used to take out on some dates every now and then for a good time, and it might have been her. Her name was Amanda something from San Diego. It was before I met the girlfriend I was initially thinking about. As I think about it more, I remember her wearing some skimpy leopard skin kind of stuff.
Were you upset?
If someone was important to me, I wouldn't take them to a rock show like that. I definitely wouldn't leave anyone in a trailer with any member of Motley Crue. There was another time where I had another girlfriend that Nikki actually fucked. She was a party girl and she was hanging out with me backstage, and Nikki, pretty much in front of me, took her and bent her over and did her. She was having her period. It was gross. She didn't even try to stop him. I'd only known her for a couple of weeks, and it was our second or third time out. She didn't become that serious of a girlfriend after that. But I didn't blame Nikki. Part of it was that girls would use me to get backstage, so I figured it was a pretty good way to find out what someone was made of. I was like 21 years old. I wasn't ready to get married or have a serious relationship. I mean, at least Nikki wasn't hiding anything. I think he said, that chick you're with is really cute. Do you mind if I bend her over? And I said, no, I don't mind. It's nothing serious. But the Vince thing, I definitely didn't know about.
I'm sorry to have to break it to you.
Yeah, I do think that with Vince, it was the girl from San Diego. And, you know, our relationship broke up shortly after that. She started acting really weird after the festival, now that I think about it, like something had happened. I remember after that weekend dumping her and never seeing her again because she was acting weird. It was probably because of Vince. At first, she probably thought, oh, I'm going to be Vince's new girlfriend and forget this A&R guy. But then she realized that she was one of 5 girls that he did in those 15 minutes. So probably then she felt trapped. She had nothing with him, but if I found out about it, she was toast. I remember her being really weird after that. So weird that I don't remember ever seeing her again.
Chapter 4. Nikki. Of the strange, improbable, and often excretory adventures that befall our heroes on a journey with the minstrel Ozzy Osbourne and his delightful consort, Sharon. It was the beginning of the end as far as fun was concerned. Unlimited cocaine. Tommy knew these shady characters in Simi Valley who would stop by Cherokee Studios, where we were recording Shout at the Devil, and bring ounces of coke. We would stay up for 3 days straight, making music and not even think we were working hard. Vince had taped pictures from porno magazines all over the wall, and girls were streaming in and out of the studio, getting fucked with microphones in the control room, bottles in the kitchen, and broom handles in the closet because we were running out of ideas of what to do with them. Ray Manzarek, the keyboardist from The Doors, was working next door, and he'd stop by almost every day, chug our booze, and leave us high and dry. We were never big Doors fans, so it really pissed us off. Out of respect, we didn't say anything, but we always wondered, if Ray was that big of a fiend, how bad was Jim Morrison? Later, cocaine would make me reclusive and paranoid, but then it was simply a party drug, something more fun to put up my nose than air. One night, Tommy, his drum tech Spidey, and I were getting drunk in a dive bar around the corner from the studio to take off the edge the cocaine was giving us. Two cops sitting nearby started getting aggressive with us, making unoriginal comments like, "Nice hair, girls." So after the alcohol kicked in and we popped some painkillers to even out the ride, we walked outside to their patrol car. The window was down, so we all lined up, pissed onto the seat, and took off running. Back at the studio, Tommy was so amped up, he threw a brick through the control room window. We didn't really know what we were doing or how to record a professional album. The next morning, we were still in the studio recording I Will Survive. There was a gong hanging by a rope over our heads, and we wound the rope as tight as it would get and then let go, so that the gong spun in circles, producing an eerie shimmering sound. As it spun, we lay on our backs and tried to chant, "Jesus is Satan," backward, which sounded like scrambled eggs and wine, or something like that. Our engineer quit that day. He said that we were all possessed by Satan, and maybe we were. We were experimenting with black magic, reading any kind of spell book or occult tome we could find, and recording invocations like "God Bless the Children of the Beast," which was actually inspired by the introduction on David Bowie's Diamond Dogs album. And maybe we were imagining it, but we were starting to attract something evil. I had ideas for the album and the tour that had to do with the mass psychology of evil behind Nazism and with the Anton LaVey books on Satanism, which was really more a personal philosophy with a shocking title than an actual religion. I had grand ideas of creating a tour that looked like a cross between a Nazi rally and a black church service, with Motley Crue symbols instead of swastikas everywhere. I even truly believed that Ronald Wilson Reagan, since each of his names was six letters long, 666, was the Antichrist. It says in the Bible that the Antichrist will have the voice of a lion to be heard throughout the nations. I told everybody that he would be shot through the heart and recover quicker than any man could, and he did. He was the devil I wanted everybody to shout at. I was getting carried away. Then, while driving home from the satanic I Will Survive session, Tommy's car blew up. Vince kept wiping out in his car. And objects would levitate and fly around Lita's and my house. We were starting to freak ourselves out. And then I had my accident. I had bought my first real car, a Porsche, after landing a publishing deal with Warner Chappell. It was my pride and joy. Tommy and I would drive down Sunset Boulevard with the pedal to the floor at 2 a.m. swigging off fifths of Jack. We didn't realize how stupid drunk driving was until a year later. Even the cops, when they pulled us over for speeding, would just make us dump our drinks out and then let us go. And we didn't think we were lucky at all. We were pissed because it was too late to buy more alcohol. After a few months spent giving that car more attention than I'd ever lavished on a girl, I went up to one of Roy Thomas Baker's parties. We all did lines off his glass piano, then took our clothes off and jumped in the jacuzzi. There were about 15 of us piled in there, including Tommy. He had finally dumped Bullwinkle and was dating a wannabe model from Florida named Honey. All of a sudden, Tommy popped a huge erection, turned to Honey, and ordered, "All right, bitch, suck my cock." She bent over and sucked him off in front of everybody.